Chapter 42. 31st of October, 4:20 a.m. Less than 2 hours until low tide.
So what you're saying is that the killer has a gun?
Connor whispers.
It's possible,
says Rose.
Great. What now?
He asks. She shrugs.
We barricade ourselves in here and wait?
Wait for what? There is no way to call for help. Nobody is coming to save us, I say, feeling just as hysterical as I'm starting to sound. Rose ignores me and checks that all 3 doors in the library are locked again, the one that leads to the lounge, the one to the music room, and the main one leading out to the hall, until she is sure that we are safe, or trapped, inside. Trixie looks exhausted and a little out of it. Her eyes are half closed. I remember that she's been drugged with sleeping pills, injected with insulin, and witnessed the horror of her mother, grandparents, and great-grandmother being murdered tonight. Her knees buckle as if she can't stand any longer, and she slides down against the wall before I can catch her. I'm amazed she's lasted this long. I sit next to her on the floor and try to hold her hand, but Trixie pulls it away. Her fingers form 2 little fists, and she wraps her arms across her chest as though hugging herself. I suppose if I were her, I wouldn't trust anyone left here either. 3 of the 4 walls in Nana's library are covered in shelves crammed full of books, but the one at the far end of the room, which has an old sash window, is what she liked to call the Wall of Achievements. It makes sense that Rose chose to sleep in this room this weekend, because most of the achievements are hers. There is a picture of Rose, the clever one, winning an award at school, some of her prizes and certificates for best this and best that, and a photo of her wearing a graduation gown and cap at Cambridge. Nana was always so proud of Rose for going to university and pursuing her dreams. Unlike Lily, who she described as devoid of ambition. Your dreams can't come true if you don't have any. Nana used to say that to me and my sisters all the time. But she did frame a newspaper clipping of Lily winning a beauty pageant when she was 10, probably to keep my mother happy. It's important to celebrate life's small successes. Like most things, they need to see the light in order to grow into something bigger. There is a framed picture of Dad conducting his orchestra at the Albert Hall in London. Next to it, there is a childhood picture of me, sitting with my father in the music room here at Seaglass. I'm holding up my Grade 5 piano certificate, and we're wearing matching smiles. Nana also framed a poem I wrote when I was 11, perhaps because writing was her passion and she secretly wanted someone in the family to follow in her footsteps. Here's what I think about people who drink, then say mean things to others, without even a blink of an eye, make them cry, or worse, wonder why they exist in this death we call life. I think those who tittle and tattle, or give the fears of others a good rattle, should be wary of making smiles fade. For what goes around comes around, and kills you without a sound, leaving you dead in the bed that you made. I confess it is rather dark, but I was a child living with a death sentence at the time. Perhaps if I'd known back then that I'd still be around now, I might have had a more cheerful disposition. But I didn't know I was living in a family full of liars. My mother lied to me, and everyone else, about how long I had left to live. The doctor who made her cry at the hospital hadn't given her bad news about my life expectancy. It was the opposite. Thanks to medical advances, that doctor thought I could go on to live a lot longer than everyone previously believed. He was right. My death sentence had effectively been revoked, thanks to science. I just needed one more operation. But my mother didn't tell me at the time. She didn't tell anyone at all at first. And she didn't sign the consent form. It was as though she wanted me to be broken forever.
Some secrets really shouldn't be shared. There are no other daisy-shaped achievements to see on the wall. Maybe some members of this family didn't think I amounted to much. Volunteering at a care home for the elderly might not seem like an accomplishment to people who have spent their lives reaching for the stars. But I was always happy to keep my feet firmly on the ground and watch the stars sparkle in the sky where they belong. I'm proud of what I do, helping and caring for people who can no longer care for themselves, being there when it matters most. Framed book covers decorate the rest of the library wall, some of Nana's own favourites, including Daisy Darker's Little Secret. Nana had Connor's first cover story on the front of the Cornish Times framed too. His father disappeared the day after the Halloween beach party in 1988, and Nana let him move in with her at Seaglass for a while. The start of Connor's career in journalism did not go well. He seemed to spend more time making tea than writing stories, so Nana let Connor do a rare interview with her, which made the front page. Then she framed it so that he would know that she considered him one of the family and that she was proud of him. Connor has worked so hard to get where he is today. He's done more working than living for the last decade. I imagine an exclusive story about the murder of the celebrated children's author Beatrice Darker and her family in an eccentric house on a remote tidal island would be good for his career. Making the jump from a local newspaper to local TV, to London and network news, before finally achieving his dream of becoming a BBC crime correspondent was not easy. I think his success has exceeded even his own expectations. But success is a drug. The more people have, the more they want. And Connor has always been a man with something to prove, if only to himself. Sometimes when people try too hard to be more than they are, they end up being less than they were. The frame on the wall of achievements that belonged to Connor is still there, but the faded newspaper article that had been inside it for over a decade is gone. I'm not the only one to notice. "Someone stole my front page," he says, taking a closer look. The frame isn't empty. Rose and I step forward to read the piece of paper that has taken the newspaper's place. It's an official-looking typed letter with only a handful of words. But those words change everything. "Dear Ms. Darker, test report for case reference DAR2004TD. Your supplied samples have been analysed and our results can be summarised as follows. Alleged father, Connor Kennedy. Mother, Lily Darker. Child, Trixie Darker. Based on our analysis, we can conclude without reasonable doubt that Connor Kennedy is the biological father of Trixie Darker. Please call us for further details if you would like to discuss these results." I stare at the words printed on the paper for a long time, trying to make sense of them. Then I remember Connor and Lily on the beach in 1988 and do the maths. I'm sure I'm the only person in the family who knew that they'd slept together, but I can't believe how stupid I've been never to have put the pieces of the puzzle together before. Lily was always very casual about sex. I thought Trixie's father could be just about anyone. It never, ever occurred to me that it was Connor. We all have to compromise between the ideas we can afford to live inside and the ones we hope to inhabit. Rose stares at Connor. So do I. He stares at the framed letter for a very long time before turning to look at Trixie, who is still sitting on the floor staring into space. She hasn't said a word since Lily died. Having a niece is as close as I'll ever get to having a child of my own. Most doctors I met over the years said that people with my condition should never risk getting pregnant, that if I did, A pregnancy would put so much pressure on my heart that it would almost certainly kill me. Trixie is my world, in some ways. I've never felt anything but love for the child since the first time I saw her. I think some people might presume that she was my daughter if they saw us side by side. We look enough alike. But now I turn to stare at her as though she were a stranger. Why are you all looking at me like that? What does it say? Trixie asks, a new frown forming on her tear-stained face. Nobody answers, because we can hear someone walking around upstairs again. Someone who shouldn't be. Chapter 43. 31st of October, 4:55 a.m. Just over 1 hour until low tide. I turn to stare at Connor and see that his face has drained of colour. He looks at Rose, then at me, then at Trixie again. I didn't know, he whispers. I was drunk. I presumed she was on the pill. If I'd known, why didn't she tell me? I look at Rose and wonder if she has done the maths too. There's something strange about the expression on her face. Lack of surprise, perhaps? I always wanted to be a better father than my own, Connor says to nobody in particular, before turning away. I think he might be crying. He never talks about what happened with his dad. None of us do. Emotional blows leave invisible bruises that can hurt just as much as the physical variety. Growing up, Connor had more than his fair share of both. All I remember about what happened to Mr. Kennedy is that the police found his car parked at the highest point of the cliff the day after the Halloween beach party, and he was never seen again. There was a note on the dashboard, but it didn't make a lot of sense. My dead wife stole my heart, and the Darker family stole my son. I'm sorry for the man life and death turned me into, and for the mistakes I made. There is nothing left for me here. Connor was 18 when it happened, and he wasn't the same afterwards. There was a funeral for his father, not that I went. I was left behind, like always. But the coffin must have been empty, because I know the police never found the body. Connor turns to look at Trixie again, then opens and closes his mouth a few times like a goldfish. Whatever words he wants to say are too scared to come out. He shakes his head and stares up at the ceiling.
I don't know what is going on here, but I'm going to put an end to it.
Connor snatches the key from Rose's hand, marches towards the door that leads to the hall, but then stops. He stares at the handle for a long time, as though it is something very complicated that he can't remember how to use. Then he opens the door, as slowly and quietly as he can.
Lock yourselves inside,
he whispers, giving the key to Rose before leaving the room and closing the door behind him. Trixie starts to cry again, and Rose rushes to her side. Everything is going to be all right, Rose says, putting her arms around the girl in a slightly awkward fashion, as though needing to keep her at a distance. Trixie stares at her before wiping her tears away with the sleeve of her pajamas. Then she shakes her head of brown curls.
I don't believe you.
I don't believe Rose either. I'm not sure who to trust anymore. All I feel is afraid of what I know and of what I don't. Anxiety builds a series of roadblocks inside my mind until it seems like there is no way out. You can hear everything in this old house. If there is no chatter or storm or TV or music to muffle the sound, it is possible to hear the creaks and groans of the building whenever someone moves inside it. With the constant soundtrack of the sea, being here often feels like being on an old ship, one that might sink at any moment. Sea glass has thin walls that like to eavesdrop, and tired floorboards that like to talk. This house has never been good at keeping secrets. The rain outside has stopped, as has the howling wind, but I almost wish they hadn't. It's too quiet now. We can hear things I wish we couldn't. And not just the 80 clocks ticking in the hall. Rose, Trixie and I listen as Connor walks across the hallway to the bottom of the staircase. We hear him walk up the stairs and along the landing until his footsteps seem to stop right above our heads. I think about the geography of the place and realise he must be in Lily's room. We hear him go back out on the landing, probably to look inside another room, maybe mine. The sounds repeat themselves as he checks each bedroom. Slow, methodical footsteps moving from one end of sea glass to the other, before stopping on the landing directly above us upstairs. "There's nobody up here," Connor says from the first floor, barely loud enough for us to hear his words. "Maybe it was our imagination, or just the noises an old house makes in a storm." Then we hear what sounds like someone falling down the stairs, and a loud thud, right outside the library door. Everything is silent for a few seconds. Rose, Trixie and I stare at one another, then at the closed door, all too afraid of what might be on the other side of it. "Did you remember to lock the door?" Trixie whispers. She looks terrified. Rose rushes forward, her hands shaking so much that she struggles to slot the key in the lock. Then she flicks off the light. Our eyes don't have much time to adjust, but it's possible to see the outlines of one another thanks to the moonlight from the window. The clocks in the hall start to strike 5 a.m. and Trixie covers her ears trying to block out the sound. It reminds me of me and my sisters when we were children, closing our eyes and counting the seconds to help us feel less afraid. 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi. We didn't only do that when there was a storm outside. 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi. Sometimes we did it to distract ourselves from what was happening inside sea glass. 1 Mississippi. Just like now. When the clocks stop, we all sit in silence again. In the dark. Huddled together against the fear as well as the cold. Then we hear more footsteps. Someone is coming down the stairs. Chapter 44. 31st of October, 5:05 a.m. Less than 1 hour until low tide. Rose and Trixie both look terrified as the slow, steady footsteps continue along the hall, stopping right outside the library door. The handle turns very slowly. Then the door shakes when the person on the other side realizes it is locked. We all hold our breath as the door rattles until the house is silent again. The sound of footsteps resumes, and I hear the squeaky hinges of the door belonging to the cupboard under the stairs. None of us speak. I think true terror always tends to steal its victim's words. Time passes. I'm not able to tell how little or how much. We listen to someone walking from room to room and the sound of them dragging something behind them, twice. Then the house is silent again. We strain to hear something else, anything else, but our ears can only find the sound of 80 clocks still ticking in the hallway, and a few seagulls out for an early morning fly.
I think they might have gone,
Rose whispers, then looks down at Trixie.
The tide should be far enough out for us to wade to shore now. We just have to get to the front door.
Maybe we should be brave and take a look.
You don't have to speak to me like I'm a child,
Trixie whispers back, looking and sounding like one.
Or we could wait,
I suggest. Bravery has never been one of my strengths. Rose ignores me, as though she might know something I don't, and takes one last look at the wall of achievements. She appears to be reading the poem I wrote. Then she says something I find so hard to comprehend that, at first, I can't answer.
I'm only going to ask this once, and I feel ridiculous and ashamed that I'm asking at all. But are you behind all of this, Daisy? I stare at her for a long time, but she can't even look me in the eye. I don't know how or why she would think such a thing.
No, I say, wiping a tear from my cheek. Rose stares at the floor, looking sorry.
But words don't come with gift receipts. You can't take them back.
Daisy would never do something like this,
whispers Trixie. And I'm glad someone in this family sees me for who I am. Rose turns to her.
Whatever happens, I want you to stay back behind me, okay? She says,
and our niece nods while standing perfectly still, literally scared stiff. Rose creeps towards the library door, leaving me no choice but to follow. Poppins tries to do the same, but my sister shoos her away.
No, Poppins, you stay here for now. We need to be as quiet as possible.
The dog looks at Rose as though she understood every word and sits back down on the rug. Rose slowly turns the key until the door clicks unlocked, and I notice that her hand is trembling. Then she opens the door quickly, as if there might be someone behind it, but there is nobody there.
Stay back,
she whispers over her shoulder as she steps out into the hall. I watch from the library as she creeps towards the cupboard under the stairs, already knowing that whatever she finds inside will be something none of us want to see. Rose reaches for the handle, hesitates, then opens the cupboard door. I can't see what she can from here, but her body language isn't good.
Stay there,
I whisper to Trixie, and she nods. I step out into the hallway to look over Rose's shoulder, and what I see shocks me more than anything else tonight. Lily's body is on the cupboard floor. Her head is hanging down as though she is staring at the mirror tied to her hand. She has been left next to Nana, Dad, and Nancy. And Connor. His neck looks broken, and there's a yo-yo wrapped around it. What looks like a newspaper page has been stuffed inside his open O-shaped mouth, and there is a red ribbon holding it in place. I have to look away when I see him.
He died eating his own words,
whispers Rose.
What?
I say.
I'm guessing that is what stuffing his own newspaper article in his mouth is meant to mean.
I take a step back, no longer able to process any of the horror I have witnessed tonight. I think I'm going to be sick. I rush to the kitchen and lean over the sink, but nothing happens. Then I look up at the wall and see that the chalk poem has changed again. Crossed out are the following lines. Daisy Darker's Nana was the oldest but least wise. The woman's will made them all feel ill, which was why she had to die. Daisy Darker's father lived life dancing to his own tune. His self-centered ways and the pianos he played
danced him to his doom. Daisy Darker's mother was an actress with the coldest heart. She didn't love all her children and deserved to lose her part. Daisy Darker's sister Rose was the eldest of the three. She was clever and quiet and beautiful, but destined to die lonely. Daisy Darker's sister Lily was the vainest of the lot. She was a selfish, spoilt, entitled witch, one who deserved to get shot. Daisy Darker's niece was a precocious little child. Like all abandoned ducklings, she would not fare well in the wild.
"Why is Rose's name crossed out?" I whisper. "She's not dead."
"I can see you breathing," I hear Rose say to someone in the hallway. I rush out of the kitchen, but not in time to see who she is talking to. The confusion I experience is sickening when the sound of a gun shatters the silence. I watch in horror as Rose falls to the floor in the hall, and I feel as though my whole world is breaking, not just my heart.
Chapter 45. 31st of October, 6 a.m. Low tide. I rush to Rose's side and kneel down on the floor beside her.
There is so much blood. Too much. I don't know what to do, but I don't think it would make any difference if I did. I try to focus on Rose's beautiful face instead of the puddle of red spilling out beneath her. The clocks in the hall all start chiming that it is 6 o'clock, and I wish that they would stop. I want it all to stop. Time never heals anything in this house. It just hurts. I'm sure Rose must be dead. But then she opens her eyes, stares at me, and frowns.
"Daisy,"
she whispers. "I'm right here, Rose. Everything is going to be okay," I say. She smiles, but it's an inadequate disguise for her pain.
"You always were a terrible liar," she says.
Then she closes her eyes. Her head falls to one side, and I know that she's gone.
"Why?"
I scream, no longer afraid.
"What have you done?"
I stand up and turn to stare at the person who shot my sister, no longer caring what might happen to me.
"You are always so loved by all of us. I loved you more than I think I've ever loved another person. Why did you shoot Rose? Answer me! Why?"
But Trixie doesn't answer. Rose's veterinary gun looks very big in her small hands. Her eyes are wide and wild. She wipes a tear from her cheek. Then she runs. Rose. Daisy Darker's sister Rose was the eldest of the three. She was clever and quiet and beautiful, but destined to die lonely. She spent her childhood with books, despite her good looks, a smart little worker bee. But achieving your dreams isn't always quite what it seems, and heartbreak is rarely funny. Becoming a vet meant more to Rose Darker than listening to her lonely heart. But there's a price to pay when you push everyone away. Some of her choices were not smart. Preferring pets to people is not a crime. In many ways, it was the right choice. So Rose worked alone, made the vet's practice her home, until no one remembered her voice. When the time came, even she knew who to blame when the gun was fired at her chest. All work and no play meant there was little to say as she took a first but final rest.
Chapter 46. 31st of October, 6:10 a.m. Low tide.
I can't believe that Trixie shot Rose, but I saw her holding the gun in her hands before running up the stairs. I don't understand anything that is happening, but I am afraid, and even more confused than before. I try to remember what I was like when I was 15 years old, but I can't imagine what on earth must be going through my niece's mind right now. My mind is blank. A child I thought I knew so well, that she could have been my own, is really a stranger to me. A dangerous one. The house is eerily silent as I head upstairs, one step at a time. Even they don't creak. I find Trixie in her bedroom, but she isn't crying or curled up in the corner as I thought she might be. Instead, my niece is searching for something in her little pink suitcase.
"Hello, Auntie Daisy," she says,
looking up as I enter the room.
"What are you doing?"
I ask.
"Getting dressed," she replies, as though it was a ridiculous question. "Can't stay in my PJs all day long when we have so much to do."
She's still crying. I wonder whether she is suffering from some form of post-traumatic stress. Maybe she shot Rose by accident. We were all so scared. Then I remember the sleeping pills and wonder whether this might be a terrible reaction to the drugs Lily gave her.
"Your mum, she put some pills in your drink earlier, trying to help you sleep."
"I know. It's not the first time my own mother tried to drug me. I didn't drink the tea. I tipped it into a potted plant in the lounge when none of you were looking,"
Trixie replies, unfolding some clothes and laying an outfit on the bed, right next to the gun she shot Rose with.
"Do you remember what you just did?"
I ask very slowly.
"You are funny, Auntie Daisy. I'm not the one who has trouble remembering things," she says.
Her tears have stopped.
"One Mississippi."
"What does that mean?" I ask.
"You always do this. Forget what really happened,"
she replies, with a strange look of pity on her face. I don't understand anything she is saying.
"Two Mississippi."
"Are you telling me that you didn't kill Rose and the rest of the family?" I ask, desperate for there to be some other explanation.
"Of course I didn't,"
Trixie starts to say, and I feel a brief moment of relief. Maybe this is just a bad dream and I'll wake up soon. But it isn't.
"I couldn't possibly have killed them all by myself. I had help." I feel dizzy and strange.
"What are you talking about?" I ask, losing my temper. "What have you done? Why would you murder the whole family? And why didn't you kill me too?"
"Three Mississippi."
"Stop being silly, Auntie Daisy. I couldn't kill you because you're already dead."
Chapter 47. 31st of October, 6:30 a.m. Low tide.
It feels like I'm falling.
"What did you say?"
I ask Trixie. But she turns her back on me and starts to get changed. She takes off the pink pajamas, neatly folding the cotton fabric before placing them beneath her pillow. I watch as she calmly dresses in a pink cotton shirt and pink dungarees instead.
"Why don't you sit down on the bed?" she suggests.
"You sometimes faint when you remember that you're dead. I've seen you do it a few times now."
"I am dreaming. That's what this must be. A nightmare. Nothing else makes sense. Which means I just have to wake up. Wake up. Wake up. Wake up."
"You're not dreaming, Daisy," You've been dead for years,
Trixie says, as though she can read my mind. I do sit down on the bed, but only because it feels like I'm falling again.
I can't be dead. I have a job. The old people's home,
I whisper. So you always tell me. But how much do they pay you these days? Trixie asks.
They don't pay me. I volunteer there.
You visit the care home. You don't volunteer. None of the staff have ever heard of you, and most of the residents have never seen you. You go there because it's one of the few places you do occasionally feel seen. People seem to see you just before they die, like Rose did a few minutes ago. And you like comforting the residents when they're scared and alone at the end. It's sweet, really, but it's not a job. It's just something you do to convince yourself you're still alive. She sighs and looks genuinely sad.
I do love you, Auntie Daisy, and I hate seeing you so upset.
Try to remember that night, after the Halloween beach party in 1988.
My train of thought has derailed. The child has lost her mind.
What are you talking about?
Please try to remember. Concentrate, she says, sounding impatient. You were on the rocks. You saw my mum and Connor doing something they shouldn't have been doing. Although, if they hadn't, I guess I wouldn't exist.
Then what happened?
I remember exactly what happened after that. I ran. Connor and Lily were both pulling on their clothes and yelling at me, but my heart was thudding so loud in my ears I couldn't hear what they were shouting. All I knew was that I never wanted to see either of them ever again. People should be more careful what they wish for. I ran along the beach in the dark until I ran straight into Rose. She was holding a bottle of wine and I noticed it was almost empty.
There you are, she said. I was getting worried. I've been looking everywhere for you.
We all need to leave soon or the tide will be too far in to cross the causeway.
Where did you go?
She was with me, said Connor, out of breath from trying to catch up. I stared at him, then at Rose, then at Lily, who had also been running. She was still only wearing a towel over her underwear after swimming in the sea, and her lipstick was a little smudged. The look she gave me made me want to run again.
I didn't see anything, I blurted out.
Rose frowned. What didn't you see, Daisy? I could feel my cheeks start to burn. The cheap wine I'd been drinking made my head feel fuzzy. I didn't know what to say, so I opted to tell the truth.
I just saw Connor and Lily having sex behind the rocks.
For a moment, nobody said anything. Then Rose laughed.
Daisy, you are a terrible liar, she said.
She didn't believe me.
Connor started to laugh too.
Wow, Daisy, that is quite an imagination you've got.
Do you even know what sex is?
Lily slurred. She was drunk. They all were.
Look at the lies little Daisy tells when she's had a couple of drinks.
I'm not lying. Lily is in love with Connor, I said.
They all laughed some more. Then Rose stopped. At first, I thought she'd realized that I was telling the truth. But then she smiled. It was her puzzle-solving smile, the expression her face always wore when she had solved a difficult sum.
Was it you? She said, staring at me. Did you shred my new blue dress on my birthday and pretend it was Lily? Have you been telling lies for years and getting away with it? Trying to start little fights between us?
Oh my God! Laughed Lily. Daisy has a crush on Connor. That's what all this is really about.
Rose laughed again, too.
"Do you have a little crush on Connor?" she asked, and her unkind smile made her beauty turn ugly.
"No,"
I whispered. "As I said, you really are a terrible liar, Daisy," Rose replied, still smiling. I stared at Connor and saw the look of pity on his face. The humiliation was worse than the heartbreak. Then Lily's face turned dark.
"Was it you who cut off my plaits when I was asleep, the night before my birthday, when everyone, including me, thought it was Rose?"
I ran before anyone could say or do anything else. Cutting off my sister's hair was the worst thing I ever did to anyone, and the guilt was never a good fit for me. I still loved my family, even when I hated them. I just wanted them to love me, too.
"Daisy, wait!" Rose shouted, but I ran and didn't look back. I must have been running and crying for over 10 minutes, mostly uphill, along the coastal road to the cliffs overlooking Black Sand Bay. That was the fastest way home when the tide was that far in, above and around the rocks down below that prevented me from just walking across the sand. I felt so alone. I kept thinking about the boy who had kissed me and called me a freak, and how he was right. I was a freak, and nobody loved me. Nobody even liked me, not even my own family. My heart felt as though it was trembling inside my chest. I was over halfway home when it happened. Right at the very top of the cliff, but so close to the sand dunes and the hidden path that would have led me to our part of Black Sand Bay and the causeway that would have carried me home to Seaglass. All I wanted in that moment was to get back to my bedroom without being seen, close the door behind me, and lock myself away from the world forever. I heard the music before I heard the car. I knew it was Connor's because of the song, "Don't Worry, Be Happy." I stopped in the middle of the road thinking that maybe he had come to rescue me, that maybe he loved me after all. My imagination started working overtime, just like always, and I pictured Connor telling me that Rose and Lily had both been nothing more than mistakes, and saying that he too wished that he had been the first boy to kiss me. But the car didn't slow down. "Don't Worry, Be Happy" blared out across Black Sand Bay as the blue Volvo got closer. But I was worried, and I wasn't happy. I remember how the sky was an inky black, and the stars were shy and sometimes hiding. I remember the sound of the sea crashing on the rocks below, and I remember how very cold I was. My teeth wouldn't stop chattering. All I had on was a denim dungaree dress, a stripy long-sleeve t-shirt, my rainbow tights and my Daisy trainers, and it was a particularly cold Halloween. I had pulled my last-minute sheet costume over myself, trying to keep warm as I walked along the cliff road. I didn't care whether I looked like a ghost. I already felt like one. Maybe a ghost was all Connor saw when he drove his dad's car into me at 30 miles an hour. Otherwise, I'm sure he would have hit the brakes. I remember the sensation of flying through the air, so high, like a bird. It didn't hurt a bit. Not even when I landed on the road. The white sheet flew too, then fell on top of me, covering my face as though declaring me dead. The car skidded to a sudden and violent stop, the twin beams of its headlights shining at the sheet, and me hidden beneath it. Then everything was perfectly still and silent and calm. Until one of the car doors opened. It was Lily's voice I heard first. She sounded very drunk.
"What was that?"
Then two more car doors opened.
Connor, I think you hit something, said Rose. You should have been watching the road instead of playing with the stereo.
I can't believe this is happening, Connor said, sounding even more drunk than my sister's. It came out of nowhere.
It, said Rose.
I could hear her slowly walking towards me, the way she would have if I were an injured animal on the side of the road. Is that Daisy's ghost costume? She whispered. Oh my God, did you hit Daisy?
No, said Connor. No, it's just a sheet.
Sheets don't bounce off bonnets, said Lily.
One of them pulled the sheet back. I think it must have been Rose, because I heard her scream first. It was a gentle scream, if there is such a thing. I wanted to reassure her that I was fine. But that was the moment when I realized that I couldn't speak, or open my eyes, or move at all. I was only 13 years old, but I had already died 8 times before. Even if my heart had stopped beating, I knew there were ways to make it start again. There always had been in the past. They just needed to get help.
What have we done? Rose whispered.
What have we done?
She screamed the words a second time, sounding hysterical.
We didn't do anything, said Lily, sounding more sober all of a sudden.
Connor was the one driving. This isn't helping, said Rose. We have to help Daisy.
She checked for a pulse, and I remember that her trembling fingers felt so warm on my cold skin. I wanted her to hold my hand and tell me that everything was going to be all right.
Oh, she's hit her head. Oh, it's very bad. There's a lot of blood. A lot.
Rose leaned down over me and I could smell the alcohol on her breath.
I can't find a pulse and I don't think she's breathing.
Rose started to sob loudly.
We need to find a phone and call an ambulance.
How?
Said Lily, and I could hear that she was crying too. We all knew that they couldn't call for help without either driving into town or driving to Seaglass, then scrambling down the cliff path and across the causeway to use Nana's landline. Both options would take at least 20 minutes, by which time it might be too late if it wasn't already. None of us had mobiles in 1988. Even now, there is no phone signal on this corner of the Cornish coast.
Wait, said Connor. We should think about this before we do anything we might regret.
What are you talking about? Haven't you already done something that you regret?
Rose screamed at him.
You've killed Daisy!
I didn't pass my driving test, Connor said quietly.
What did you say?
Rose asked.
I didn't pass my driving test, but I didn't want to tell you that I'd failed. How could I confess to my genius girlfriend who was about to head off to Cambridge that I couldn't pass a simple test? I lied.
For you.
And I didn't ask to borrow my dad's car tonight because he would have said no. He knows I don't have a license.
Oh my God.
Rose whispers.
I'm going to jail, Connor says. They'll say it's manslaughter. I've been drinking. They're going to lock me up. My life will be over. I'll never get a job after this.
I just wanted to drive my girlfriend to a party before she left for university. A girlfriend who was probably going to dump me anyway. And now I'm going to jail. I was never going to dump you. Why would you think that?
Rose says.
This was an accident.
An accident I am going to regret for the rest of my life.
Do we have to make things even worse than they already are? He asked.
What do you mean? Said Rose. Daisy is dead. Nothing could be worse. I'm sorry that you lied about having a license, and I'm sorry that you're going to get in trouble, but this is your fault.
Is it? You both knew that your little sister was at the party tonight when she should have been safe at home. Your parents will find out that neither of you looked after her or tried to take her back to Seaglass. You let her drink alcohol, then left her alone on the beach despite her being underage and having a heart condition. You bullied her and made her run away. Your family will hate you just as much as they will hate me for the rest of your lives.
I wanted to tell them that I was fine, that they didn't need to worry. But I still couldn't move.
He's right, said Lily. They will hate us.
Have you both lost your minds? Said Rose. What are you suggesting? That we leave her here on the street like roadkill?
No,
Connor said. And I felt such an overwhelming sense of relief until he spoke again.
I'm suggesting we throw her over the cliff.
Even if I could have spoken at that point, I don't think I would have been able to.
Think about it, he said gently. I know how upsetting this is, but Daisy really didn't have much longer to live anyway. We all know that. Every doctor she ever saw said her broken heart wouldn't last much longer. She was a good person. She wouldn't want you or me or Lily to have this hanging over us, like a noose around our necks for the rest of our lives. Her life is over, whatever we do. But ours don't have to be. It will look like an accident. All we have to do is go home and keep quiet. Say that she wandered off and left the beach without us realizing.
I could hear my sisters crying, both of them. I imagined myself sitting up and us all hugging with our arms wrapped around each other. I knew they would never be mean to me again, not after this. I thought maybe we would become the best of friends and that one day we might even laugh about the night Connor accidentally hit me with his dad's car. But that isn't what happened.
Come on, before another car comes along and sees us. I'll take her feet,
Connor said, picking me up by my ankles.
No! What are you doing?
Rose screamed at him.
I didn't think my sisters would let it happen. But then Lily held my hands in hers. I could smell her favourite perfume. Poison.
I think he's right, Lily said. We're all going to be in so much trouble otherwise. We can't do this. Stop it. Put her down, Rose argued, and I could hear a scuffle. She's already dead. What difference does it make? Lily replied.
Until that moment, I never really believed that they were going to throw me off the cliff, onto the rocks and into the black waves below. I wanted to kick and scream and bite them to make them let go, but I couldn't, and they didn't.
Are you sure you want to do this?
She's your sister, I heard Rose say.
I don't know, said Lily, starting to cry again.
We don't have a choice, said Connor.
It was a lie. Life is only ever a series of choices. We all have them, and make them and regret them every single day. The ability to choose between right and wrong is a fundamental part of being human. But Connor's humanity got lost that night, and I fear he never found it again.
On three,
he said, and Rose sobbed. I could feel Lily's hands trembling as she held on to mine. The waves crashing on the rocks below sounded like thunder in my ears. Connor started to count, and they swung me back and forth as though I were the old skipping rope we used to play with on the beach.
One.
Mississippi.
Two.
Mississippi.
Three.
Mississippi. When they swung me the third time,
I could hear my heart beat in my ears. It was louder than Connor counting, louder than my sister's crying, and louder than the cold, dark sea crashing on those rocks beneath me. Looking back, I wonder if the fear I felt produced so much adrenaline that it restarted my heart. Just as they let me go, I opened my eyes. I was flying again, and I smiled at Rose, Lily, and Connor. Because I was alive, and everything was going to be okay. But they did not smile when they saw my eyes open. They stared back in horror as I disappeared over the cliff and fell down, down, down into the icy cold black sea.